Law and Economics Podcast is a production of the Journal of Law, Economics, and Policy at George Mason University School of Law.
Welcome, everyone, to the first lecture of the 2006-2007 school year for the Journal of Law, Economics, and Policy. I'd like to introduce Gavin Young, our moderator for the evening, counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee. This event will be recorded and available later for audio and visual listening on iTunes, so if anyone's interested, then later you can pass this along to anyone else. But without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to Gavin so he can introduce the panelists, and then we can get started with the lecture entitled, Will Federal Banking Regulations Force Online Casinos to Fold?
Thanks, Amanda. Are we on? There we are. Thanks to JLUP and also to the distinguished panelists for taking the time to put on, I think, a very fruitful discussion on something that's very timely. And I first want to preface this by qualifying that, although I do work for the Senate Judiciary Committee, the things I say here, should they be an opinion, do not necessarily reflect those of either Senator Arlen Specter or other members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Also, as an aside, I also want to make clear I was not directly involved in the passage of the legislation that's in question today, so please don't blame me. A little over a month ago, on September 30th, President Bush signed in the Security and Accountability for Every Port Act of 2006, or also known as the Safe Port Act. He signed that into law, and the last title of this law was the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Regulation Act of 2006, which many of you have probably read about a little bit in the newspapers. After this bill was signed, it generated almost immediate results, and some speculate far-reaching results, but I guess that's a question that we're going to be trying to answer today. This bill, in various forms, was basically the culmination of about 8 years of effort and experience, probably beginning, I think, with its first introduction by Senator Kyle back in the 105th Congress. It's also in response to findings by a commission entitled the National Gambling Impact Study, and they were commissioned to basically generate a report back in the late 90s to basically explore what should be done about gambling as a whole, and they actually devoted a specific section back in the late 90s generating recommendations and findings about what should be done with internet gambling. Among the reasons for prohibition cited in this report and probably which is the reason which for the bill that you see today has to do with access to access by minors to these sites. I think there's a legitimate state interest for people to be basically prevent minors and children from going into these internet gambling sites and placing bets. Obviously, children can't do that at bricks and mortar casinos, so why should they be able to do that on internet sites? There's also a legitimate concern about pathological gamblers and basically the whole idea of gambling as an addiction, which many people do suffer from. And also, finally, a more consumer protection-oriented idea that these offshore gambling sites, if they're based solely on the internet, there's no way to enforce, perhaps, if a site decides to refuse to pay winnings or manipulate the game such that you think that you're playing according to certain odds, but in fact you're not, there's really no way to protect an end user from those sorts of things. Specifically, the Commission came up with a couple of particularly relevant findings. First, it recommended that if Congress acts to prohibit internet gambling, that it also require the National Institute of Justice or other appropriate agency 12 months after the effective date of that statute to measure its effectiveness for a period of 1 year. Basically, I think this is a recognition that we're kind of in uncharted territory in terms of regulating a specific activity over the internet. Of course, the more relevant recommendation, and I'll read from it in part, is a recommendation that the federal government should prohibit without allowing new exemptions, internet gambling not already authorized within the United States or among parties in the United States and any foreign jurisdiction, with the further recommendation that the President and Congress direct the Department of Justice to develop enforcement strategies that included but are not limited to internet service providers, credit card providers, money transfer agencies, makers of wireless communication systems, and others who intentionally or unintentionally facilitate internet gambling transactions. I think that's probably a lot about what we're here to discuss today. Now, I'll read briefly from what I think is the operative language of the bill that I just told you was passed. And I'm starting from Section 5363 in case you're interested. It states that no person engaged in the business of betting or wagering may knowingly accept in connection with the participation of another person an unlawful internet gambling, credit, proceeds of credit, electronic fund transfers, checks, drafts, or similar instruments, or other proceeds of any other form of financial transactions. And most of the portion of that section is dedicated to basically directing the Secretary and the Board of the Federal Reserve to actually come up with these policies to basically force the banks and other financial institutions to identify and to flag basically any of these questionable transactions and then to basically refuse to transact those. There's also civil remedies to allow attorneys general of the various states to enforce their own particular rules. And also, there's a criminal provision such that if you violate this title, you may be fined and imprisoned for not more than 5 years. So that's basically the overall impetus of the text. Let's see. I guess I'll leave any further interpretation to the distinguished panelists. Finally, I'll just leave it with a quote also from the commission that generated this report. And this is basically an overall quote recognizing that this is sort of new territory. It says, to say that gambling has grown and taken shape in obeisance to government decisions does not imply that there was a well-thought-out overall plan. All too commonly, actual results have diverged from stated intentions, at times completely surprising decision makers. There are many reasons for this awkward fact. So I guess without further ado, to discuss the benefits and the burdens and possibly the inefficiencies of this bill, I'll start with Steve Verdier, who is a senior vice president and director of the Congressional Relations Group for the Independent Community Bankers of America.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for being here. I was thinking that perhaps this should have been held on Halloween rather than tonight for this reason. Our members, our 5,000 members, plus really all the banks and financial institutions in the country are heavily involved in the payment system, and you'll learn more about the payment system than anybody really needs to know this evening. Unfortunately, this bill had the potential. I don't think it will, the way it's written, but I think this bill in earlier versions had the potential to really disrupt the payment system. We're talking about 36 billion checks every year, at least as of 2004, and 12 billion electronic transactions in the same year. I think the number of checks has gone down. The number of electronic transactions have gone up, but I think the net amount is probably the same, probably much more. But the reason it was scary is that a lot of times we deal with issues that potentially put a burden on the nation's banks, and that's just kind of goes with the territory. But here we had a moral issue, if you will. A lot of people thought that what was going on here was was wrong, was morally wrong for people to be gambling on the internet. And that's pretty tough to say, well, this is going to be a burden on the financial system. But no burden should be, so great, I think, in some people's minds that that it shouldn't be borne. But we decided to to take up the cudgel anyway. This bill had been kicking around quite a while. The reason it passed this year is because of Jack Abramoff. He took credit for killing an earlier version, and the members of Congress decided that one way to kind of get right, to get on the right side of the scandal issue, was to pass this bill. It had always been killed previously by the gambling lobbies. They never really got out of the shadows, but they were able to kill the bill, particularly in the Senate. And of course, the problems between the House Banking Committee and House Judiciary Committee also conspired to make it hard to pass. House Financial Services Committee went ahead and passed the bill without a hearing this year, and there was some process behind the scenes. We were able to get some things done, but the Judiciary Committee also took jurisdiction over the issue, and we were able to get a witness before that committee and explain the problems that community banks and everybody else would have about this. And this is your lesson on the payment system. We talk about the nation's payment system, and the question is, well, what in the heck does that mean? Everybody in this room uses the payment system probably 3 or 4 or 5 times a day. If you have a credit card, you make a payment. That's one part of the system. If you write a check, that's another part of the system. If somebody takes that check and puts it in front of a scanner and turns it into an electronic blip that goes against your checking account, that's what's called an ACH transaction, electronic transaction. And those transactions go through very, very quickly. It's you can't imagine what goes on behind the scenes when somebody swipes that credit card. There's an awful lot of work going on at the computers at Visa and MasterCard when that happens. And it's kind of like the water company. If it works, you don't have to know about it. Nobody should have to bother. If you had to worry about the water company all the time, you'd drive yourself crazy. But there are critical differences between the systems and what they can do. And if the idea is to track illegal internet gambling transactions, the credit card operations have a way of tracking the merchants or the recipients of payments. They have that system because there's a credit risk involved. They're taking a risk when they make a payment to a grocery store, a liquor store, an internet gambling store, a pornographic site of some sort that may be legal. They're taking a risk, and there's more risk the further down the spectrum you go. And so each type of merchant has a particular code. And so if there's an internet gambling code that's out there, and there is, the credit card operations can just block payments to those sites. And as a matter of fact, they've been blocking payments to those sites for several years. So this bill really just tells them to do what they're already doing. But that works. There's a finite number of merchants. A lot of merchants, but there's a finite number. In terms of payments made with the checking account system and the ACH system, everybody on the planet with a bank account is a potential recipient of a check or an electronic payment. So tracking and blocking those would be quite a task. And the technology isn't there. When a bank clears an electronic transaction or a check, all they really have, the only information they have about that payee is the bank account number and the bank's own number. Each bank has a unique number. So there isn't any information about the type of recipient that you have. And so there are regulations under this bill, and what they say is if it's not reasonably practical or feasible to track and block these transactions, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve shall exempt. In the House language, it was shall consider exempting. And we thought that they ought to do, if they can't do it, they ought to just flat exempt. And we worked very closely with the Senate folks, not as closely as I would have liked, but we did work with them on that language, and they dropped the word consider. And so we've got a pretty strong directive to the Fed and the Treasury. Don't disrupt the nation's payment system. Don't stop you from, you know, using your checking account or electronic transactions. An unanswered question, is there some midpoint between a complete tracking and blocking system and just a full exemption? We'll have to find out about that. A couple of other tricky items. There's a requirement in the new language, the latest language, that says that regulations should protect transactions that are gambling transactions that are legal. In other words, the regulations are supposed to say, you know, block the illegal ones, but you got to let the good ones go through. We don't know how they're going to do that, and it flatly contradicts other language that had been earlier in the bill or in earlier versions of the bill that says that a financial institution overblocks transactions, blocks legal transactions, they're protected from liability. So they don't have a lawsuit risk, but is there a regulatory risk that financial institutions have? Darn if I know. Lawyers smarter than me are kind of puzzled by that apparent contradiction. But some of the good news that the business of betting or wagering is not included as a as part of a financial transaction. And the other thing that gives us quite a bit of comfort is the regulations that apply to financial institutions are going to be the sole way that we're going to be asked to comply, we hope. Court injunctions are not to apply against financial transaction providers under this legislation. Now, what we're worried about is if some clever prosecutor, and they're all pretty clever, I suppose, will come up with something outside of the bill to use as an excuse for an injunction. And so then we'll have a federal judge who is probably not an expert on the payment system, probably knows less about the payment system than you all now know, might be enforcing and directing that the entire payment system of the United States be transformed so we can track and block these transactions. So like I say, very scary for the entire financial services industry. We think we've got language that is reasonably protective, but it was a long, hard slog getting it done, but I think we were reasonably successful.
Thanks, Steve. Next we have Houman Shadab, who is a senior research fellow at Mercatus Center, and specifically in the Regulatory Studies Program.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Anytime the government regulates market activity, it's always an uncertain question how the market participants are going to react in response to the regulation. And that's even more the case when the regulation itself introduces uncertainty into how to comply with it and how the market participants are going to react in general. Now, this legislation and the regulations that are going to be promulgated pursuant to it introduce some uncertainty. And so here it's interesting to note how the financial institutions, the gambling companies, and the gamblers are going to be reacting to the legislation. So first, to understand the rules a little bit, let's quickly just go over what it does and what it doesn't do. As has been stated previously, what the legislation does, what the two primary rules of the legislation do, are to prohibit gambling companies from accepting funds from American bettors in violation of U.S. gaming law. And the second and the real meat of the legislation is that it requires financial institutions to block, identify, or otherwise prevent or prohibit those type of illegal transactions from going through. In other words, banks, credit card companies can't send those transactions to gaming companies in violation of U.S. law. Now, credit card companies, as was already said, already prohibit those type of transactions because it's easy for them to identify who are the gambling merchants and simply disallow them to be used with their credit cards. And that's been going on.
It's not easy, but it's possible for them to try.
Right. There's a code 7995, I believe, which the credit cards use.
Yeah. So it's and they've got to make sure that the illegal internet gambling site actually uses that code instead of one for a grocery store.
Right, that's true. And that's assuming the merchant actually complies
honest,
with that.
Yeah,
exactly. And in any case, it's much easier to identify for credit cards than it is for banks. And I just want to look at a couple quick provisions of the rule and then see what uncertainty it creates, what market participants have been doing, and what are the potential outcomes, in particular with third-party offshore banking or financial or e-wallet institutions like PayPal, which is an American one, though. Okay. So 9 months or 270 days from when the bill was passed, the Secretary of the Treasury the Board of the Federal Reserve, in consultation with the Attorney General, have to promulgate regulations telling banks and other financial institutions how they can go about identifying, blocking, prohibiting, or otherwise preventing their businesses from being used to send funds to unlawful gaming sites. And they can do that either simply by identifying and blocking or choosing their own method of prohibiting. And the regulations are going to come down. They should give examples of how to do that. They should give some guidance. And they should allow the fine institutions, according to statute, some leeway and some method of choosing in between them. And as also said earlier, the financial institutions can't exempt compliance with the law to the extent that it's impractical, and it probably will be impractical for paper checks and what have you and electronic fund transfers to have to go through each separate transaction and identify who the payee is. And also what the statute does, it creates no liability for overblocking as long as it's done on a reasonable basis. So if a bank blocks a transaction which was not going towards a gambling site, they cannot be sued under this law because so long as it was done under some reasonable manner. And the issue there is if it gives an incentive for banks not to be completely diligent in looking over these transactions, knowing that they have a shield from liability. And the problem there is it creates at the margin, amount of legal uncertainty to the extent that financial transactions are not going to be processed in the way they should be processed because they're being blocked for some undue reason. For example, there might be merchants that call themselves party poker or party gaming or something that have nothing to do with gambling, but the banks just start blocking them because they have a reasonable basis to do so, obviously based upon the name of the merchant. Okay. And one other provision of the statute is somewhat curious, at least to myself, is that it limits enforcement against financial transaction providers to the extent they are acting as financial transaction providers. That would seem to limit enforcement of injunctions, temporary restraining orders, or what have you against institutions to the extent they are acting solely as banks or other financial intermediaries. But that could also cause a very large loophole in the very law itself because it applies to financial transaction intermediaries, which would include, by some, if you stretch that definition, credit cards, banks, and other types of institutions like that. So what's the upshot of all this? Well, the implication is that this law is unlikely to have an effect on some of the major players, at least in the long run. This law does not apply to gamblers, so it doesn't create any new illegal types of gambling. It doesn't, in fact, change any substantive rule of gambling. What it does is, like the title says, just changes the enforcement, how the gambling laws, which are already on the books, although they are subject to much disagreement about what is actually illegal internet gambling. It just creates a new method of enforcing those laws. And as I said earlier, banks will likely get exempted in the ways that would hurt them from having to go through their checks. And credit card companies already block, or to a large extent, gambling transactions. So the law is somewhat redundant as applied to them. And there's a chance that the law also might not apply to poker to the extent that the poker players can successfully argue in a court that playing poker is predominantly a game of skill and not a game of chance, because under many state laws, if you can argue that a gambling law will not apply to a game that's primarily of skill as opposed to a game that's primarily of chance, which would be betting, like roulette, lotteries, and things like that. Okay, now the two big problems for enforcement of this law is that the United States has no jurisdiction over foreign entities operating illegally, foreign businesses, to exercise jurisdiction and prohibit them from doing what is legal in their countries through either injunctions, court orders, or fines, or what have you. So one thing that's important to realize from there is that given the economics of the industry as it is today, prior to the bill being passed, is that most, if not all, gambling companies are offshore. They're not United States entities at all. So this law has nothing to say about them, does not apply to them directly at all. And the United States cannot seek enforcement or injunctions against a company that's operating legally in Europe, for example, or in the Cayman Islands or the Isle of Man. Now, most importantly, the U.S. has no jurisdiction to prohibit offshore financial institutions like banks or offshore e-wallet or digital wallet companies like a foreign version of PayPal from operating for the very same reason. It's simply a jurisdictional issue. Now, why that matters is because the one of the primary ways gamblers currently fund their accounts in the offshore gaming companies' websites is by using a third-party offshore payment provider like NetTeller. NetTeller is the biggest one, and what NetTeller is a company that's located in the Isle of Man, not subject to U.S. jurisdiction, operating completely legally over there. And what it does is it takes payments from U.S. residents, and once your money is in a NetTeller account, you can use the money and the funds in there to purchase gambling services or a wide variety of goods and services around the world, not just gambling. So the U.S. has no direct jurisdiction over those types of transactions. So to some extent, the law, to take a step back, doesn't matter at all because people can just start moving funds into third-party offshore accounts and fund their gambling from there. Although there is a slight wrinkle, and there are some ways U.S. regulations and regulators might be able to get to those entities also. But two other statutory reasons why they could not would be the limitations on enforcement for financial transaction providers, which I already mentioned, which it could be interpreted to apply directly to the offshore providers. And also Section 5362, of the Act, which says that a bank or other insured depository institution, by putting money in there, does not constitute a bet or wager. So basically, by putting money into a third-party offshore account, I'm not making a bet. That act in itself is not a bet, so that's not prohibited under this act. It's not considered a restricted transaction. Okay. On the other hand, though, there's some leeway for regulators to come in and stop those third-party processing transactions from coming to the fore. And again, that's important because that seems to be, post this statute, the primary way which people are going to effectuate gambling transactions. And the basic idea there is that you can't do indirectly. The law prohibits you from doing directly. Okay, so let's just say a company starts up and it's called Offshore Gambling Wallet LLC or something. Well, the government might not be too happy about banks having their customers deposit money into this offshore wallet digital wallet company, whose sole purpose is to fund gambling, which would otherwise not be legal in the United States. So the regulators can simply pass a blacklist telling United States financial institutions, which are certainly under their jurisdiction, from putting money into those accounts. But the problem with companies that are not obviously used solely for gambling is that, for example, eWallet and those other companies, you can use the funds in those accounts to buy other goods and services. And furthermore, on some of those e-wallet companies, they route their transactions through third-party offshore banks. So even if the only reason you're using this third-party account or its sole purpose is to facilitate gambling, which would not be legal in the United States, a bank in the United States might never know that because all they see from their end is another bank on the other side. So there could be layers of banks or third parties or financial intermediaries which make the enforcement problem a big issue once you basically leave U.S. shores. So those are sort of where the issues play out. And some companies like NetTeller have stated that until the regulations come out in 9 months, they're going to continue to operate subject to U.S. law, but they don't know exactly what that means because if there is a certain amount of regulatory uncertainty. But the second largest, or one of the largest e-wallet companies owned by FireOne, they announced just recently that they will immediately cease to process settlement transactions originating from the United States. So there is a liability risk there. There is an exposure, that's for sure. And so they're just pulling out and not accepting any transactions from U.S. residents. And in fact, even though gaming companies are offshore are certainly not directly subject to this law, the public ones at least have also withdrawn from U.S. markets and seen their stocks take a large hit because there is potentially some liability risk from accepting payments from U.S. customers. So that's all that I want to say now. Just in sum, that the biggest issue is whether or not individual gamblers in the United States are going to be able to fund their transactions going forward through these third-party offshore accounts. And if they are able to do that, then the law is really not going to have much teeth. It's just going to change the structure of the industry and bring to the fore these third-party providers that are offshore as opposed to sort of going directly through banks or what have you. But if those transactions are somehow cut off too, then the industry will take a real big hit. American bettors will have many financial, if not legal, problems going and doing bets online. So that's sort of where I see the big issue with this law.
Thank you. I just want to add a couple things. First, possibly one of the biggest reasons why some of these companies took a large hit after the bill was passed is because right now I think there's an estimated 60% of their revenues are currently generated from the United States, and that is 60% of their business comes from here. Also, I just want to add maybe a couple of reasons why this particular statute might be particularly useful. And the first is that the predecessor statute to this, or one of these statutes which bore upon, possibly internet gambling, was 18 U.S.C. 1084, which I believe the language prohibited wire transfers with respect to illegal or unlawful gambling. And there was some ambiguity there, and there was a little bit of a disconnect between some American companies who would have wanted to enter the arena of internet gambling but could not, simply because the Attorney General had the opinion that this sort of activity was illegal and they would be prosecuted, whereas there was basically any of the offshore sites, say in Gibraltar or Isle of Man or a few of these other places, would not be, simply because there was an ambiguity, and therefore, generally, at least to the criminal provision, ambiguities, as we know, are construed against the government. And I guess finally, to add that part of the difficulties in some of these regulations is that there are some bets that are legal. This law basically had the intent of, or had the general thrust of, making illegal or adding a federal crime to what was already illegal by the individual states. And there's actually a carved-out exception for gambling over the Internet to and from a jurisdiction where it's already legal. So, for example, if a certain type of gambling is legal in Nevada and it's also legal in a particular Indian reservation somewhere else, if those two endpoints are allowing a certain type of Internet gambling, then to gamble over the Internet would be allowed and permissible. And that's why I guess there might be some difficulty in parsing out those particular transactions while keeping or prohibiting the transactions where there's a jurisdiction where it's illegal. And finally, I just want to add the point that this regulation also came about as a result, surprisingly, of the individual states, which brings an interesting federalism dynamic to the table. Generally, states, when they have a traditional area of enforcement, they want to keep enforcement of that. But the National Association of Attorneys General put forth a request saying we need federal regulation in this because it's too hard to regulate any kind of activities over the Internet. And I guess it's up to – we're going to find out if the federal government, in fact, can do that also. I think the states met with limited success back in the mid to late 90s. And attempting to enforce their own regulations against gambling over the Internet. Finally, we do have Michael Gordon, who is from the office of Congressman Jim Leach.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. I apologize first off if I'm a bit out of sorts. This has been a tough week. You might have seen that Mr. Leach was not reelected on Tuesday. So I just got back from Iowa, and it's been a difficult couple of days. But it certainly was not because of authoring this bill that he's no longer in Congress or won't be in January. The bill's taken a couple of hits at this table so far tonight, and I'll try to take a step back and give you a bit of a background as to why we passed this bill, why this law is necessary, and why I think that some of the points that you've heard already are incorrect. For nearly a decade, many in the Congress sought to deter internet gambling, but time and again, the issue was stymied, often in ways that reflected imperfectly on the institution. But while Congress failed to act, the illegal internet gambling business boomed. This year, Americans will send more than $6 billion to unregulated, offshore, online casinos, half of the $12 billion that are estimated to be bet this year worldwide. FBI and Justice Department experts have warned that internet gambling sites are vulnerable to be used for money laundering, drug trafficking, and even terrorist financing. Further, these sites evade rigorous U.S.-based regulations that control gambling by minors and problem gamblers and ensure the integrity of the games. It is fundamental for a society to protect the security of its citizens. Here, it's relevant to note the testimony before Congress of Dennis Lormel, who was then chief of the FBI's financial crime section. Quote, it's, the internet gambling and online capabilities have become a haven for money laundering activities. We believe there is a huge potential for offshore sites being utilized to launder money, and there are examples of pending cases, particularly in our organized crime program, involving enterprises using these types of services as conduits for money laundering. Likewise, in a formal report, the U.S. State Department expressed a similar concern. The internet gambling operations are, they write, in essence, the functional equivalent of wholly unregulated offshore banks, with better accounts serving as bank accounts for account holders who are, in the virtual world, virtually anonymous. For these reasons, internet gambling operations are vulnerable to be used not only for money laundering, but also criminal activities, ranging from terrorist financing to tax evasion. Internet gambling's characteristics are unique. Online players can gamble 24 hours a day from their bedroom. Children can play without sufficient age verification. And betting with a credit card can undermine the player's value and perception of cash, which also leads to addiction, bankruptcy, and crime. Unlike in brick-and-mortar casinos in the United States where legal protections exist and where there's some compensatory social benefit in jobs and tax revenues, internet gambling sites principally yield only liabilities to America and Americans. Cannot be stressed enough, from a macroeconomic perspective, there are no social benefits to internet gambling. And from a microfamily perspective, there's enormous harm that's frequently inflicted. Professor of Business at the University of Illinois has called internet the crack cocaine for gamblers. There are no needle marks, he writes. There are no alcohol on the breath. You just click the mouse and lose your house. And these comments really couldn't be more apropos than they are for Greg Hogan, who is a 19-year-old sophomore at Lehigh University, class president, chaplain's assistant from Barberton, Ohio. The pastor's son gambled away $7,500 online playing Texas Hold'em and confessed to robbing a bank to try to recover his losses. His life's ruined. Internet gambling has become as much a part of the college experience as late-night study sessions, rooting for the football team. Researchers have called it addictive. Players attest to becoming obsessed with it. The activity is illegal, but the law was not being enforced. Never before has it been so easy to lose so much money so quickly, and at such a young age. Internet casinos are proliferating, and soon, had we not acted, they would have become ubiquitous. In the next 5 years, had Congress not acted to enforce the laws banning internet gambling, and had internet casinos' business plans come to pass, gamblers would have been able to place bets not just from their home computers, but also from their cell phones while they were waiting in line for the movies, from their Blackberries while they were sitting in traffic. It would have been absolutely ubiquitous. Now, Mr. Leach introduced the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act to prevent Americans from gambling online. This law, in our view, creates strong tools to help federal and state governments to enforce existing gambling prohibitions. It was designed to cut the money flow from gamblers to internet gambling sites. Specifically, the bill enhances criminal penalties for gambling businesses settling internet wagers with financial instruments such as credit cards, and it also requires payment systems to establish procedures for blocking these transactions. And we've heard about the jurisdictional issue, and I want to take a moment to just comment on this. There were two approaches, one that was offered by Mr. Leach, which is a financial transaction approach, an enforcement approach. How do you deal with casinos that are located offshore outside the reach of the Justice Department? You can't arrest a casino operator who lives overseas and has all of their assets offshore. There are no injunctions that you can reach these people. But what they're doing is they are breaking the law. The 1961 Wire Wager Act is clear in our view. Internet gambling is illegal, whether it's poker, sports betting, roulette, or craps. You can't bet online. That's been the interpretation of the Justice Department in the Clinton administration, and it's continued by the Justice Department today. Now, Bob Goodlatte offered a different approach. He's a congressman from Virginia, and he believed that the best way to enforce the internet gambling laws was through a definitional way and changing the definitions in the Wire Act to make it absolutely clear what's legal and what's not. Make it clear which games are included. We supported this completely. But from a political perspective, it became extraordinarily difficult, and we can talk about that later. we ultimately were only able to pass this bill because we had the acquiescence of the banking community, in some ways the gambling community, the Indian reservations, the horse tracks, the dog tracks, the high lie courses, the family groups, the sports leagues, the NCAA, every major sports league. And this was sort of a lobbyist's dream and a staffer's nightmare, and that every time you corrected a problem, another one popped up. And every time you maybe made a concession to one group, another group needed something too. And so it was extraordinarily difficult to pass this bill, and it largely was because I think we finally were able to thread the needle. And that included, or that didn't happen to include, a definitional approach to the Wire Act. We can go into this later if you have questions or want to hear more about it. But this measure was supported by the NCAA, all of the major sports organizations, financial services industry. Steve's group, the ICBA, was a lone wolf, really fighting against this bill for years. But family groups, religious organizations, and 48 of the 50 states attorneys general, and the Association of District Attorneys, had broad support. Now, the reason the sports groups supported this legislation is that they were concerned with the integrity of their games. A $12 billion industry had boomed in the internet casinos. You had a valuation for some of these casinos that were traded in the British Stock Exchange, that one company could have bought every single team in the NFL based on their paper valuation. Now, the temptation there is just too great for players and for the sports. We watch football every Sunday, and we watch college games on Saturday, because we believe that the outcome is determined on the field. The first commissioner in sports was ever appointed in response to the Chicago Black Sox scandal, where they fixed the World Series. So this was an existential question in many respects for the sports leagues. They fought so hard to pass this bill because you need to ensure the integrity of the games. And these casinos were operating in an unregulated way. There was no way to control their behavior. Now, family groups supported this bill as well. And it's certainly not a subject that's touched upon, and as Mr. Leach said on the House floor, in the Quran, the Old or the New Testament, or the Bhagavad Gita. But the pastoral function is one of dealing with families in difficulties, and the religious leaders of all denominations and faiths are seeing gambling difficulties erode family values. Now, finally, the reason why the Justice Department and State Attorney's General support restraints in internet gambling relates to the challenges of law enforcement, both for gambling and non-gambling activities. Because, as I've said earlier, internet gambling was too easy. It was just too easy to be used by narco traffickers, terrorists, to launder money. And whenever an area of activity is lawless, it has a tendency to spin out of control. Now, it's been suggested that there shouldn't be any call to rein in activities of individual choice. But it should also be clear that in the history of the Western world, wherever gambling has been legalized, it has been subject to careful regulation. And that's simply not the case with the internet. Nor is it the case that an individual's misjudgments do not affect society as a whole. There is nothing in internet gambling that adds to the GDP or makes America more competitive in the world. Indeed, if an individual can't repay his or her credit card debts, neighbors are subject to higher interest rates, it affects us all. Everyone loses if this industry continues its remarkable growth trends. Entertainment's multidimensional, but gambling and gambling online is not the same as bowling. There's no home, no office, and no college dormitory should be a casino. And American law varies by state, but generally makes no moral judgments on the wisdom of gambling. The law, and now as a caveat, I've been a gambler all my life. I grew up in Los Angeles and have gone to casinos for years and years. I have no moral problem with gambling. But internet gambling is something that is so unique, and it's a problem that is growing and was becoming so big that if we didn't deal with it, it was going to only spiral out of control. And the fact that we didn't deal with it 10 years ago, when the internet boom really happened, it was something that needed to be remedied. It was something that needed to be fixed. We let this Congress, not we, Congress, by failing to act, let this industry grow. And they finally have acted to prevent it. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have. But finally, it's just in a, it should be stressed one last time that internet gambling was never legal. And in a country where the rule of law is the cornerstone of our society, upholding the law is fundamental. We finally needed to enforce this law, because if we didn't, it had a potential to really undermine everything that we believe in. Thanks.
Thank you. I guess at this point we can open it up for some questions. I strongly encourage asking questions is a very good opportunity. I think I'm going to go ahead and ask the first question, and it's directed primarily at Steve. I was just wondering, is there a difference between the large banks and the small community banks that you represent that is relevant to your opposition? Is there a unique burden to the smaller banks that the large banks possibly don't encounter?
You know, I think not, and this gives me a chance to respond to something that Michael said or clarify. We did issue some very strong statements about this legislation. They were always along the lines of it's very burdensome and we want you to fix and reduce the burden. We never said we hereby oppose the bill. And I just wanted that to be clear. But
you had the Chamber of Commerce do that.
Well, since we're not members of the Chamber of Commerce, they speak for themselves under the First Amendment. And a lot of people were exercising their rights under the First Amendment during the pendency of this bill, and there were an awful lot of complaints about that. But in any case, the question was whether there's a unique burden. And I think in working with my colleagues in the financial services industry who preferred to work behind the scenes, we didn't prefer to work behind the scenes, and sometimes that was to our benefit and sometimes it was to our detriment. But in any case, I think we had some good success. But our interests were really identical, because our members issue credit cards, and the primary burden on the credit card companies is at the Visa and MasterCard level, because it's really up to them to process the payments, regardless of whether the card's issued by Bank of America or whether it's, you know, the First National Bank of Podunk or wherever. And in terms of checking and these electronic transactions, the processes at the small banks and the large banks are pretty similar. You have to automate these systems. Of course, the electronic systems are by definition automated, and they'd again run through systems that are really outside the bank. And I don't think a big bank would have any easier time going through individual checks to see if someone was foolish enough to write payable to Joe's illegal internet gambling site. I mean, no bank, small or large, could possibly do that. It's just beyond comprehension. So I don't think there's any particular difference between small banks. I think we may have presented a little more sympathetic case, and Congressman Goodlatte was good enough to not only to listen to our witnesses' testimony at the House Judiciary Committee, but come back and address our concerns and work with us on our concerns. And of course, Mr. Leach, a longtime supporter of community banks. Iowa has probably got more community banks per square county than anybody else. So we had good support, and politically, sometimes that's a little more effective than Bank of America comes in. You don't get too many violins out for B of A when they come in and ask for something, no matter how meritorious it might be.
Thanks. If anybody has questions, I think this microphone, I'm not aware, that's the one for people to come and ask any questions. Does anybody have anything at this particular moment? If you could speak loud enough, I think it would be fine.
We're on TV.
Actually, we may
if you want to be downloaded on iTunes, I think you probably need the microphone.
Well, just in full disclosure for Michael, I work with the Poker Players Alliance, and your boss has been great. We were able to sit down and meet with him, and he heard our views, and we really appreciate the opportunity to meet with him on this issue. We've been very vocal in opposing this legislation and looking towards regulation instead of prohibition. And a couple of the issues that you raised is the problem with internet gambling, money laundering, problem gambling, etc. The issues that were raised by Human was that the third-party banks are going to kind of come up, spring up overseas, where people would then funnel their money through that. Won't that create a larger problem for money laundering than what was either currently going on through it going through U.S. banks or U.S. debits, or if we actually were to regulate the system and have it more transparent where U.S. banks were actively engaged and it was more, like I said, more of a transparent system?
I was pretty stunned to hear the suggestion that somehow these third-party payment systems weren't envisioned or aren't included under this bill, as they were absolutely considered every step of the way and have been, without question, included. It was absolutely our intent, and we believe absolutely the effect of the bill, that a credit card company and a bank will be, under the regulations that will be prescribed, I believe, hope July 13th, they will be forced to identify and block a restricted transaction to any internet casino or facilitator of internet gambling. And that would include a third-party payment system that's funneling money to one of those casinos. We always, through this process, used the example of NetTeller. NetTeller is an offshore payment site that many of you probably know that derives approximately, and this is very much a ballpark, 80% of their revenue from internet gamblers and 20% of it from pornography. That's just a tidbit. But for NetTeller to continue to use, to continue to have U.S. customers, we envision that what NetTeller would likely have to do is essentially create NetTeller 1 and NetTeller 2. NetTeller 1 would be used for internet gambling and NetTeller 2 for everything else. And NetTeller 1 would be blocked. A U.S. citizen or someone with a U.S. bank account would be blocked from interacting with NetTeller 1, but not from NetTeller 2. And so you could continue to buy, you know, pornography or whatever else through NetTeller 2. But certainly we envision of the bill is that the Federal Reserve and Treasury, when they prescribe regulations, will include these third-party payment sites.
This one's for Michael also. You mentioned that the pornography, a lot of that comes from NetTeller. And you mentioned also that this law had a moral underpinning, supposedly. What's the justification for prohibiting rather than regulating gambling but regulating pornography? Since pornography seems like it has the same potential to ruin families and whatnot.
Certainly dealing with that was beyond the scope of what we were trying to do. That was never our intent to deal with pornography in any way. But it's a really good question. Where do you draw the line? Can you – and that gets to a question that we dealt with a lot through this process. A lot of people suggested that the internet is just too big. You'll never be able to prevent some internet casino from popping up, and you'll never be able to do it well enough. And I would suggest that that's not necessarily the case. I think the problem here is really one where you have to make a choice. If you're able to regulate, that means you also still have to be able to block those other casinos that aren't regulated. So you have to have a mechanism to prevent transactions that go to those casinos that are somehow going to be outside the scope of the law. And if you're going to regulate, that means all of the internet casinos have to exist in the United States, because that's the only way they'll be within the jurisdiction of the U.S. Justice Department. So you have these casinos. Let's say you have MGM Grand and Harrah's operating a casino, an internet casino in the United States, and it's regulated. You protect problem gamblers, kids. You don't allow credit card pop-ups on the website to come up after you've maxed out your credit card. All of those things. But what do you do about the Bodog that exists? And Bodog is just an example, but that exists offshore, that allows a 16-year-old to somehow get online and bet with their parents' credit cards. How do you do it? So you have to have one. You have to have a mechanism that blocks out these transactions to some of them. So I would suggest that the issue you're asking about isn't one really for this law, because we don't change what the law is. The law is that internet gambling is illegal. The problem was the law wasn't being enforced. And so how do you enforce the law? Well, you had to cut off. You couldn't do it through the Justice Department. You couldn't do it through injunctive remedies or criminal penalties. So you had to come up with a different mechanism. And we came up with a system to cut off the money. You deal with the regulations, and you cut off the lifeblood of these casinos. You're going to have to do it somehow, because if you're going to regulate or allow some online casinos to exist, by just you have by implication, it means you have to prevent some other casinos from existing. And so we've just come up with a mechanism that prevents all internet casinos from existing or having access to the U.S. market. And someone down the road, Mr. Leach won't be in the Congress, and certainly there are some, but someone down the road might try to introduce something to regulate internet gambling. And I think that down the road that's a judgment that people can make, but they're still going to have to be able to enforce the law against those companies that aren't regulated, and we think this is an effective mechanism.
I think I'd like to put a similar question to the other two panelists in that it's a question of imperfect enforcement. Sure, you could possibly, there's a way to, you know, channel it through 18 different intermediaries, but as we saw from the immediate effect of the bill, there were some sites that lost a dramatic amount of market share, stock value, because of the bill's passage. And is that not a good result in the sense that this was an illegal activity and it is a question of enforcement? These companies had prospectuses that said, on the London Exchange, a majority of our profits come from the United States where it is illegal. Isn't that a good result, and isn't that sufficient to justify a sort of enforcement mechanism such as this?
Well, from the perspective of the drafters of the statute, and certainly that would be the case at least initially, but I think there still is a big problem with not so much the net tellers of the world, because those can be blocked when the regulations come down. Net teller is a big target. We all know about that. But how about the next net teller, the next company that's smaller, it's private, it's underground, and people can just put the money there? I still haven't, in my mind at least, heard a satisfactory answer as to how you're going to prescribe money from going to those types of organizations. So the effect here is an effect of prohibitionism with all the attendant consequences to that, namely driving an activity between consenting adults underground and the criminality that arises from that, the opacity between the company and the bettor and what have you. I don't think it's really an issue of good enforcement, because I don't think the enforcement is really going to be too effective in the long run. What will be effective in the long run is the ability of third-party offshore companies that are not in existence today, but that will soon arise in response to profit opportunities to fill a demand, to fill a very large demand in the market, namely American market, namely for internet gambling. And just on one point, internet gambling has actually not been found to be illegal under United States law. That is simply the interpretation of the Department of Justice. And actually, in 2001, Henry MasterCard International, the Eastern District of Louisiana, expressly found, through, in my opinion, quite solid legal reasoning, that only internet sports gambling, sports betting, is legal for a company to do, and that internet poker and those types of games are not illegal over the internet. That is simply a posture the government takes, and certainly reasonable, but has not been one that's been accorded by any courts, and certainly not the Supreme Court of the United States.
Well, one of the problems we had, we sure don't want to have to decide as banks what's legal and illegal in terms of internet gambling. That's way beyond our expertise. I think the immediate effects were more kind of enforcement via publicity. You had some publicly traded companies that just didn't want to be seen to be attempting to circumvent U.S. law, and so they shut down. Our concern really, and if every internet gambling site went out of business, they finally saw the light, they realized how foolish their activity was, that would be fine with us. It's certainly not an activity our bankers encourage among their customers. Our only concern really is that the payment system, the check and the electronic system, just isn't configured and really can't, in a practical sense, be configured to effectively track and block these transactions. It sounds easy. It's easy to say those words, but they can just track and block, but it it just can't happen. And so if there's some other way to enforce this that's effective, either moral suasion, publicity, or you just scare the hell out of people, that's fine. All right with us. We were cautioned, frankly, we were urged by the incoming chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, don't go along with this bill because, you know, you're going to be the enforcement. The monkey's going to be on your back. And we did not oppose the bill. It's usually a good idea to take Mr. Frank's advice, but in this case, we did not. And I think we can live with the bill as it panned out. And whether it's effective or not, we can't judge. We're not going to draw a roadmap for people who want to try to get around it. We just don't want it to burden the payment system because we want people to be able to, you know, make those payments so they can pay their electric bill and buy their groceries and all the rest of the things that have to go on through the payment system. That's our interest. That's the beginning of our interest and the end of our interest in this particular legislation.
Are there any other questions out there? I mean, how are we looking on time?
Hi, I'm a first-year law student here, and I happen to be a member of the Poker Players Alliance. Glad to see they're here today. My question is, what's the next step? Will the groups that are behind this bill, I mean, whether it's genuinely effective in stemming internet gambling, or whether it ends up being rather toothless, we've kind of heard both sides. I mean, will the groups that are behind this be satisfied in the moral victory of getting the bill passed, or is there going to be an attempt to maybe bring enforcement down to the level of the people who are actually playing? Is there going to be an effort for the banks to maybe put restrictions on people's accounts who are exercising or who are making these transactions if they're having trouble determining where these transactions are going? Just curious about what the next steps are.
I can tell you there is absolutely no appetite, no interest from any member of Congress. Well, there were a couple of members of Congress, but the vast, vast, overwhelming majority of members of Congress have no interest in going after individual gamblers. None. Absolutely none. So you can rest easy that the government's not coming after you if you aggressively try to evade the law. Sure.
I'm not saying I can't rest easy. Some people can't rest easy because of concerns. Currently, NetTeller, for example, is a very reliable and safe and a payment service, so I'm told. major poker websites advertise on TV. They pay out. They pay out what people are owed. People depend on their honesty. And so there's a concern that, if there's NetTeller 1 and NetTeller 2, well, maybe those won't work. I mean, your example that's how NetTeller is going to deal with this presumes that NetTeller is going to want to comply with you. Now, if they start making, hundreds of variations that the banks can't track, it just opens it up for fraud. If other people step in, if NetTeller steps out of the industry, they may not be as trusted. The websites now that are overseas, they have protections. You can't deposit a whole lot of money all at once if you've lost a bunch recently. They do these things voluntarily. And if they were in the country and regulated, they could be asked to do more. But by driving this underground, players cannot rest easy. It probably will discourage some people, from playing, which I guess,
good
is the goal. But many of them don't really think it's such a bad thing to play. So I don't know. I mean, but anyway, I digress. I mean, back to the next steps.
Well, certainly the next step are the regulations that are going to be promulgated, and then it's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen. I would assume that the bigger companies like NetTeller, they would stop processing transactions from Americans, American banks, just to be on the safe side, if not just simply because people will stop sending funds to NetTeller. What will happen after that is that new probably very shady companies might prop up, or at least not as safe, not as open as NetTeller, and then the problems with that will come along. I also don't see anybody getting prosecuted, especially by the federal government, for individual gamblers getting prosecuted. And the problem is, though, if someone wants to fulfill an appetite for gambling, I haven't seen any study that says internet gambling is any worse than gambling in-house, or, for that matter, gambling in state lotteries. State lotteries are pretty notorious for having the worst odds in terms of and the worst sort of social effects in terms of who actually uses them. In fact, online gambling sites, because they have lower overhead, like poker sites, and because they do have some level of skill involved, if not a lot, they actually tend to have higher rates of return for individuals. In addition to the fact that if you are a professional poker player, it is a zero-sum game. For every win, there's a loss on the other side. However, if you play, for example, professionally every day consistently, and some casual players, they lose to you, what you're doing is you're creating a living for yourself, while casual players are losing a little bit of money in recreation. So in that sense, it is an economically efficient and wealth-creating act, as opposed to the state lottery or something like that.
I would add, it's possible from a reading of this particular statute that, in fact, state lotteries also, if they have an internet component, they might fall underneath the certain regulations and the way the statute is written. It's a possibility, at least.
Another thing in addition to the regulation is to, you know, watch your papers to see whether some prosecutor tries to get an injunction for some reason outside of the statute against banks and other providers. We're hoping that doesn't happen, but that's something to watch for.
This actually is an interesting point that you just raised with the question of internet lotteries. And this was a central debate that went on. I mean, truly went on for months. So how do you deal with it? And we wanted no betting online, and we wanted no carve-outs, no exceptions to betting online. And the question is, can a state lottery offer lottery tickets via computer? And in the legislative history of the bill, we make it's explicit that that shall not occur. And it was something that was interesting. A person who was involved in this process, in this legislative process, was at a Memorial Day picnic, and was taught. Someone had asked her, what have you been working on? And they said, internet gambling. I've been doing a lot of work on this bill. And he said, well, you know, you can buy a lottery ticket online. And she was shocked. She's like, really, how? How can you do that? I've never seen that. Well, in the state of Virginia, you can, or you could. As long as you had a Virginia driver's license that said you were over 18, you would have been able to buy a lottery ticket online from Virginia. Now, only Virginians. However, we've added something that's very precise. There has to be sufficient age and location verification. So not where Virginia's law was about age and residency verifications. And currently the technology on the internet, you can't with certainty verify your age or your location. What computer? I could be sitting at my desk in Washington. It doesn't know where I am. And so we believe, at least at this point, that online lottery sales won't occur.
I do think as a practical matter, though, your kind of forecast is correct. You probably will see a lot of the larger corporations take significant hits, and you probably will end up with maybe a number of smaller groups and organizations that are, you know, kind of shadowy, or it's much more difficult to target them. I think the overall effect of that would be then to drive out a lot of the casual users, because unless you're a very serious user, it'd be very hard, at least from my perspective, to go and sign up my credit card number for some unknown organization I've never heard of from the state of Estonia or, you know, anywhere else. So I think that could be a legitimate and intended effect of the bill, regardless of the fact that if you are determined, you probably will be able to get access to internet gambling. But again, it's a question of, have you ever caught all the fish in a single pond? You know, I think the effect will be to do a lot, I think.
Well, certainly the standard, it's not fair to, the standard is not perfect enforcement. That's not fair to the drafters of any statute. But if you're only going to drive away the casual user, I thought the real issue here was the hardcore, addictive gambler who will do anything and open up an account in Kazakhstan and to gamble. So,
Borat can bet.
Unless there's any other really pressing questions, I might end it on a more of a lighthearted question. Particularly, you brought up the suggestion that there are some games out there that could be considered games of skill rather than of chance. And so I'd just like to put the question to you. Texas Hold'em Poker, is, in your opinion, is that sufficiently a game of skill, or is there some chance involved? I would just say, unless you have a royal flush, it would seem that there's always a chance that you could lose any hand, and therefore it would be chance. And if, you know, it's pretty good.
I actually don't know the specific rules of Texas Hold'em Poker, but there's certainly chance involved in any act, and including any sports act, but there's also, I do believe, I've played poker enough, which is not that much, but enough to know that there's quite a bit of skill involved. And there's reason there's tournaments, and there's reason people persist in their performance and win over successive periods. And it must be due to skill as opposed to luck, which luck is, by definition, randomly distributed throughout the universe. So I would say there's at least a significant amount of skill involved.
All right. I think a final word for everybody would be appropriate.
Personal experience, I don't play poker, but my father was a police court judge in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and once threw out a case against poker players sitting around somebody's living room on the grounds that it was a game of skill and not a game of chance. The Good Burgers of Grand Rapids, Michigan were not pleased with his decision, but it was his decision.
I'll just say that I ran track in college, and every time I got in, track is probably the sport where there's the least bit of chance or luck involved, especially when you're a sprinter. It's either you win or you lose, and it's on any given day you're faster or you're slower. It's not if the ball was tipped or you called an extra timeout. Other factors are involved. Either you win or you lose. And the question of Texas Hold'em, is it a game of skill or is it a game of chance, is a tricky one. But I would say that the people who argue that it's a game of skill are taking this down a very dark route that they shouldn't probably want to take it. We generally think of sports as games of skill. Basketball, game of skill. And all of these games are defined not as their games with their games of skill are generally considered sport. And I think that the poker players, the more they continue to suggest that Texas Hold'em is a game of skill, the closer they get to considering to creating a definition of poker as a sport. And a sport, as all people would say, are covered by the 1961 Wire Act, and then Texas Hold'em is going to be included in the Wire Act as well. And so I think it's a pretty dangerous argument to make.
Right. Yeah, I think the bill is pretty broad in terms of covering poker and anything else. So, I mean, that's an interesting distinction under a different law.
Unless there's any other final words or any final questions from anybody, I think it's be appropriate to close. Just as a final aside, in case you're interested in reviewing any or looking into this yourself, the particular law we're talking about is Public Law 109-347. And the Wire Act that is referred to here, in part, it is encapsulated in 18 U.S.C. 1084. And I would also suggest going to the National Gambling Impact Study Commission website. I think if you type that in, it's fairly easy to find. And they have a very voluminous report laying out a lot of details. And unless there's anything else, I think it's...
Gavin, as our moderator, and all the distinguished panelists for coming out tonight. And thank everyone. As I said, this will be available online approximately within a week from our website, which you can be found through the George Mason website. And so thank you from the Journal of Law, Economics, and Policy for all those attending and all those participating.
Thank you.